Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Bartlebaugh, and I'm joined with Chris Durham. Chris.
Hey, guys.
How are you doing this evening?
Doing great. I'm ready for a delicious podcast, if you catch my drift.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we are here on the cusp of Thanksgiving, and we're back. We were trying to think of how to approach this, discuss feasting. We mostly handle the horror aspects of Phantom Galaxy. In fact, we've mostly had horror episodes so far. We wanted to take a more, like, grotesque, I guess, would that be appropriate?
That
grotesque
would be.
Approach
yeah.
with feasting. And we've mostly limited it to movies. I mean, we haven't gotten to too much in the way of books, but I think we can discuss that, too, if you want. But we were discussing the concept of doing a podcast that talks about feasts or grotesque feasts in films. Not just horror movies.
Horrible
because
feasts.
I think horrible feasts, yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll get into that in just a moment, but we're at a point with Phantom Galaxy where we've taken a few sort of initial jaunts into podcasting, this kind of being, I'd originally spun this off of Pop Culture Ninja, and that podcast is continuing, and we are now looking to get into more regular schedule with this podcast, so we're going to see more episodes. There's going to be some episodes that are more family themed. We're going to have some episodes that are more science fiction themed as well, and book themed and things like that. Chris,
mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And Chris will be joined for as many as you care to join. But what we're going to do is start with some giveaways as well. So at the end of this podcast, I will have some details about how you can win a Blu-ray copy of The Thing, which is
yeah.
The Thing from 2011. Is that the full title, Chris?
It's just The Thing. Yeah. Okay. We actually talked about that, I think, on our first episode.
We did,
opened
yes.
up the horror pack.
And since then, Chris and I both had gone to the Senator end of October to see John Carpenter's The Thing on the big screen
at
the Senator, which was really a
cool
experience.
That was a treat.
Experience.
That was cool.
Yes.
I never got a chance to see that on the big screen, so it was really, really neat.
I had not either, and it was neat to see the special effects haven't really... They've aged, but they are still effective. Special effects are still effective. I don't know that special effects these days are always effective. So,
and I noticed, too, if the movie felt a lot more menacing on the big screen because more of your field of vision isn't capturing the whole thing. Like, just watching it on a small screen, it's very effective as a movie there. But also on the big screen, like, just stuff that there's a scene with the wolf walking down the hallway and the sound coming from all angles into your ears in the theater just makes it that much creepier. I thought it was a much better experience.
Yeah, when the husky is going from, like, room to room.
Yeah, like, it gave me chills, and that didn't when I've seen it, like, on DVD or Blu-ray various times.
Well, we walked into the Senator, which is kind of a big, vast chamber.
Yeah.
You know, it really is a big room.
It's huge.
That the first thing I did was, like, let's go to the front. So we went about as far back as you would be without being just totally overwhelmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that helped a lot, because you're right. Like, the early going of it, and actually the whole movie has a very claustrophobic, very encased feel to it, more so than I remember, because I remember the monsters and the special effects, but the monster special effects are sort of punctuated in between all the, like,
paranoia,
people giving shifty glances.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kurt Russell staring at Wilford Brimley, yeah. Wilford Brimley staring back at Kurt
There's
Russell,
a lot more
and Keith David staring
too,
at both
than
of them.
I remembered, like you say, just the long glances at people's
yes.
faces. It was really cool seeing some of their expressions and how much humor was in that movie.
Yeah, so stay tuned after that. We're going to kick off the giveaways with The Thing. We'll talk about how you can get a copy of that. And we have a few other prizes and contests we'll do as we go along, but we're going to start ramping up Phantom Galaxy and start getting regular weekly podcasts to you. But tonight, we have a special Thanksgiving episode, which if you're poised to eat or about to eat, or if this is a post tryptophan podcast listening, I will give you the warning that some of the movies we're talking about today are a little bit on the gruesome side.
Yes.
We're not going to get full-fledged disgusting here, but what we did want to do is kind of just talk about feasts in movies and the concept of what does it look like, particularly in a genre film, with science fiction, fantasy,
yeah.
when you want to convey something about a world that's a little off-kilter, but you want to do it with something as mundane as eating. You know, because I think lots of times in movies, it's a very common thing to see somebody eating something. It's
yeah.
an amazing thing when you can take a director that takes something like eating or cooking and turn it into a work of art. Movies that fall outside of what we're talking about, movies like Babette's Feast or like Water for Chocolate or Big Night or any kind of movie, even the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi. You know, movies that take something like food and just through the visual medium elevate it. What happens when you take the flip side of that and you want to nauseate somebody? Or, in the horror perspective, take something that is so taken for granted and turn it on its head a little bit. So without further ado, we're going to go into this. The way I think we're going to do it is just sort of go back and forth. And Chris, you even came up with a few interesting, funny categories.
Well, you know, yeah, I have a few categories. And I actually thought I'll give a few honorable mentions, a few lighthearted ones to kind of get us going. So we're not into full, like, weird, creepy, kind of gross territory right off the bat.
Before we start, though, I want to ask you, what, in a scene in a film, if you've got a film and either the entire movie or portion of the movie is dealing with something like eating, and let's talk about from the horror perspective, because I know you're not that squeamish when it comes to horror films.
Yeah.
How do you feel about a scene involving a feast when it gets a little bit gruesome or out of the ordinary?
Now, to be honest with you, that is one of the few things in the horror films that kind of disturbs me, because it is such a thing that we take for granted, is things that we do every single day, and it's just so mundane. But when you see it kind of changed and turned disgusting or whatever, like, that really affects me, actually. I've never been a fan of, like, some gross stuff. So some of the stuff on these lists that we're going to talk about, I personally am not a huge fan of, but I think they're worth mentioning. It becomes revolting to me, kind of, you know.
I think, too, there's a distinction that we've kind of made. We were discussing what will we include or not include. Mm-hmm. And we decided not to include just, oh, this is a podcast about gross food or gross meals. Mm-hmm. And it's not even necessarily gross, but rather sinister or horrible feasts. And the feast, to me, is like a completely different thing, because there's a ritual to it. There's an element to it where there's certain...
There's the human element.
Social rules involved. So you're seeing a social convention be turned on its head.
Yes.
Like, it's one thing for someone to bite into a sandwich that has a mouse or something in it, or the, you know, the lady eating the fried chicken, it turns out to be a rat. Like, all that's gross.
Yeah.
But what about when you have a scene from a movie where the entire dinner convention is turned on its head and it's twisted by the people involved? Mm-hmm. So, let's get started. What do you got?
Well, you want to start off with a few lighter things to get going? Or do you want to delve
Sure. Right. And I figure that we can, you know... Yes, these are movies... Some of these movies are even kids' movies that I think we have on the
list.
Of
them, sure. So, I have a few categories, as you mentioned. I have some honorable mentions. I have a list I call Family Feud, where we will talk about some movies with, like, some memorable argumentative folks around the dinner table. Dinners of the Damned for the bizarre and or horror kind of stuff. And of course some cannibal culinary delights.
And I feel like cannibalism is the main area where you get to, like, the grotesque.
Yeah, so I don't actually have a ton on there because I don't want to get too crazy, but
And I've got some we can add as well. And let me ask you, and should I at the end of this talk about my own horrific Thanksgiving experience?
Ooh, that is so good. That is so good and also so gross.
We'll save it for the end. We'll give people warning.
This you know what? This will be a teaser. You have to listen through the podcast. Is he going to do it? Is he not going to do it?
Yes, there you go. So,
well, to start off, let's go with the... I'm going to show some honorable mentions that I thought were cool but may not be perfectly appropriate for this. So, Nathan, for the most colorful puddings in a film, what would you say really hits the mark there?
The most colorful pudding in a movie, I know it can't be that movie because the movie I'm thinking of is nauseating. So you must have saved that one for later. Most colorful pudding in a movie, what is it?
Well, we're going to go with Hook.
Hook.
They have all those, like, weird multiple color, like, puddings and stuff on the table. It's like half of what the kids eat.
Well, in the scene in the Hook, so Robin Williams is Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. He's Peter Banning, who thinks he's Peter Pan. He returns to Wonderland. No, he doesn't go to Wonderland. He goes to Neverland. And he goes back there to get his children back from Hook. Mm-hmm. And I think he's in the process. The Lost Boys are trying to train him to get back in the mindset of...
be the Pan again.
Yes, to be the Pan. And they're not eating anything, at least to his eyes, right? Yes. This is the, like, scene where he clicks for him, and suddenly they're eating bowls of, like, Nickelodeon Gak is what it looks like, right? It's like, isn't it, like, phosphorescent...
all kinds of stuff.
And they just start having, like, a food fight.
Yes, this is also memorable for a giant food fight scene. So, now, if you think about a series of movies with the most, like, consecutive feasting scenes...
Well, let's go, just very briefly, go back to Hook. My problem has always been with Hook is it seems like at that movie, and I talked about when we did the Spielberg thing on PCN, felt like the movie lacked imagination. And I feel that scene is a good example of they're imagining eating food and he can't see it or visualize it. So when it starts to appear, wouldn't it have been a neat thing for him to start to see, I don't know, like roasted beasts or or something fantastical? And then when Spielberg just went to the way of like the gack looking glop that they were eating, didn't make any sense. Why would the Lost Boys be eating piles of slop? Like, I just thought that was a
toxic
bankruptcy of imagination. Well,
no, I agree. I actually am not a huge fan of Hook either. There is some creativity in it, but for the most part, you think it would be a little more fantastical.
Cause especially from Spielberg. It felt like every time
he's a crazy visual guy.
He had the opportunity to do something imaginative, like again, like to see a dragon or something on that play. I mean, that would
roasted
have been
dragon
something.
Would be
but that they picture slop is just
So, anyways, back to think of a movie franchise that has the most consecutive scenes of feasting, like in its series. I think this one's kind of an easy gimme.
Feasting scenes in a series. Yeah. Is it a horror series?
No, it's a fantasy series.
A fantasy series. It's got to be Harry Potter. It's
absolutely
be.
Right. I mean, you know what? I was jealous because if I was a kid, I'd be in there at the the Great Hall 24/7.
So, what was your favorite feast scene in a Harry Potter movie?
I'm going to be honest with you. I thought the very first film was the best feast scene to me, simply for the fact of you go in there and there's all the candles hovering above the tables and stuff. That was really cool. You see the wonder in the kids' eyes as they're sitting down and this magical feast is prepared before them. And something like Harry, you've never seen something like that before. I just thought it was a cool scene. I liked that one from the first film.
That's probably, that's the one that does stick in my mind. I think eventually they got to a point in those movies where the feasting was secondary because they were in such peril all the time. And we never, though, in that movie too, I don't think we ever got a really good look at some of the meals, we got some of it. We got the butter beer and the stuff like that and the different things they had. But that first movie is sort of the first introduction they really have to the world once they get to Hogwarts is when they walk in and they look up and they see like how they, it looks like it's raining or something. They can see the clouds and everything at the top of the like cathedral dome.
It's a magical moment.
Nearly Headless Nick is floating in and out. And I love that kind of thing of like the feasting often being the introduction to characters in a fantasy world. Like when they get to the world that one of the first things, particularly some of the old British authors where I always felt they were hungry while they were writing.
C.S. Lewis comes to mind.
Like, because if you think about it, like when the kids get to Narnia, like the kids are either, they're taken by Lucy meets Mr. Tumnus and he offers her food and everything. And then, and I think it's intoxicated, isn't it? It's like intended to make her go to sleep or something. And then when Edmund comes in, he gets fed the Turkish delight. So he's like, right off the bat is hit with that. And when you said what franchise, I was thinking it's either Harry Potter, but it could be Lord of the Rings because the hobbits do eat a lot.
Darn you. Most musical feasting scene involving whole wheels of cheese.
The Hobbit. Okay, I forgot that you had that.
All right, well, that was...
I was just remembering Samwise lamenting that they didn't have fish and chips while Gollum was looking at the roasted rabbit and
what's
the gagging.
All right. Well, those are just... and then, of course, now this
How
is kind of shifting.
How long was that scene in The Hobbit? So in The Hobbit, it's when they come in and they basically... Bilbo is swatching them like tear his pantry apart and cook a giant meal. Pretty much. And there's the big guy, like you said, is like eating a wheel of cheese or something. And
singing songs while doing so.
That was an incredibly long
it
scene.
It was a very long scene.
Yes. And I think I see why Tolkien incorporated those sorts of things. It does show that like sense of community who the hobbits are.
Mm-hmm.
But man, is a movie. Like, I think you have an opportunity to like impact somebody with a scene like that. But after a while, you've just lost all sense of it. And you're just watching the dwarves eat.
Yes.
And sing.
So lastly on the honorable mentions, moving on to a little bit darker territory, hopefully a little more horrible feasting, although actually still pretty good. Best nightmare feast. If you were to think in your horror film knowledge, what's the most appealing feast in like a nightmare world?
There's a couple that come to mind. So are we talking, if we're talking nightmare feast, this is in this isn't quite a horror film, but pops to mind that dinner sequence in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Like, if you were to say Nightmare Feast, I'm just thinking of that scene where he goes there. And, of course, people criticize that for saying that, oh, this is, It's sort Indian of showing the Indian culture that eat brains and spiders and everything. But of course it was this over-the-top pulpy sort of thing.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's just the specific, like, thuggy cult culture that surrounds it. But that dinner scene with the monkey brains and everything going on was pretty revolting as a kid. And you're watching it unveiling it. And you're right, like, it creates that sense of dissonance where, oh, he's out of his league now because he's in a world where they're eating all these horrible things. And to me, that had a nightmare dreamlike quality that didn't necessarily fit with the rest. It fit with the parts where the villain is ripping the hearts out and stuff like that when the feast set itself apart from the rest of Indiana Jones, and it was dark and weird in the same way that, like, the opening of the Ark of the Covenant was, and Raiders and things like that.
I'd say that's very close. I like that. It's a little bit different, though, because I was thinking of a feast that you'd actually want to eat, but you're in a, like, weird nightmare world or something. Something to tempt you, or...
So now I'm thinking more like Dracula. You know, like Dracula invites Jonathan Harker
to
his place.
Strong choice. I like it.
And you, while he's there at the dinner table, I don't think we ever really see in most of the... we might see in the Bram Stoker's Dracula, but when he's sitting there getting ready to eat, you know, Dracula's shadow is sort of all around him and stuff like that. I remember in one of the movies, like, they had the steak tartare or something. Or Lost Boys, though. They're just noodles, Michael. But they were worms. So that's a feast I would have thought of,
too. You know, that's a strong selection. I like that, too. I went with Pan's Labyrinth. I thought because they had that sequence with the
pale man and the eyes. Oh, my goodness.
The eyes, his hands. And they had, like, this piece, like, don't eat any of it. It would be stuck there forever.
That's like, that's a really good choice. And that's probably a better choice than the ones I was thinking of. Pan's Labyrinth, yes. So the scene when she comes in and she basically isn't... there's three fairy tale challenges or something that she has to overcome. And is this the second one?
I think this is the second one, yeah.
Yeah, and she comes in, and there's a big, beautiful feast of food, like, in front of her. Mm-hmm. And she sees, like, the pile of shoes over in the corner or whatever, right? And it's like, and the creature sitting at the end of the table has his hands up in front of
his face. The eyeballs.
But the eyes are on the hands watching her. And then the question is, will you take from the food and cause the thing to chase you?
Or just do what you're supposed to do and get out of there.
Just get, man. But the allegorical nature of that whole movie where she's so tempted by the food and she can't, it's like she doesn't really have the, she isn't going to bypass it. So she's going to, like, enrage the guard or whatever. But the course of the film, the thing she learns by violating those laws is essentially in keeping with what she's doing in the real world. But I guess it depends on how you view that movie, whether the
world.
Yeah, what did you think about that scene in context of large? I think we both agree Pan's Labyrinth is a great movie.
It is. I thought it was good because it does show her consequences to her actions, both in the real world and in the
And I think a
fantasy.
Few fairies get eaten in the process of that.
Yes, and Pan is pissed. He's like, because of you, I have a few less fairies floating around now. Yeah, I really like that sequence particularly. I think it's one of the more visually rich sequences.
It makes that scene seem real, because people have complained, well, half of what she does is a dream, but it doesn't feel like a dream. It feels very real and immediate and terrifying.
You know, there's this guy I recommended at work this movie to, and he watched. He's like, you know, you missold it to me. He told me it was like a dark fantasy movie. It was just a couple of sequences of fantasy. I was like, oh.
Everyone's concept is different of fantasy, and it's I know what you mean. It's like, I wasn't recommending Narnia. This is it's a different movie, and that was probably why we appreciated it, because it was a little refreshing. You know, I wasn't your average.
So do you want to move on to a little more horrible?
Well, you've been sliding into it. Pan's Labyrinth is pretty darn creepy.
Yeah. Well, on the lighter end of horrible, we can go with some of the more interesting family feud sort of element. I call them that. It's mostly just because everybody's sitting
family
around the table.
Family feud. Okay,
yes.
I can relate to this.
Sitting around the table with all their family members. And as you know, in reality, real life, you know, the holidays are a wonderful time, but there's always the possibility of things that could happen with your family could explode at the table. You never know. So one of my favorites...
They could literally explode at the table.
Exactly. Actually, this one's rather recent. I liked... I'm going to go with Krampus. I thought they had a great dinner scene where they're all sitting around, like, just trying to, like, peck each other to death verbally while they're, like, eating this feast.
What I love about your choice of Krampus is Krampus is a movie that's filled with monsters and creatures and special effects and mm-hmm. horribleness. Yes. But there's no supernatural horribleness in the scene you mentioned in the feasting scene. True. The dinner sequence is just, it could have been taken from like any dark comedy movie. It's just the acerbic, horrible nature.
I mean, it is like Christmas Vacation. A certain element of Krampus is very much like Christmas Vacation.
It's almost halfway between Christmas Vacation, where everyone's kind of lovable doofs that they overlook, but they're just oddballs. And The Ref. Did you ever see The Ref with Dennis Leary?
I never did see that.
Okay, that has one of the most acerbic biting dinner sequences. And I don't mean physically biting. That I've ever seen, where Dennis Leary was, and I talked about this, Dennis Leary plays like a cat burglar who gets stuck in this. He runs into a house and takes a couple hostage, and he's going to just wait out till his buddy comes back. But their whole family comes over, and he has to basically preside over this dinner where people are saying horrible things to each other. Like, at one point, Kevin Spacey, who's the patriarch, gets up and tells his mother, next year, you know what I get you for Christmas? A cross. So you can climb up there and hang yourself on it whenever you're not feeling appreciated enough.
That is
and
awesome.
It's just venom. There's a line in there.
Wow.
Grandma's chewing through her gag. And you just have this hatefulness. Krampus is kind of interesting because people are saying they're shooting daggers at each other, but they almost don't even really mean to. Like, they're so accustomed to
it. Yeah, exactly.
Like, everybody's in their own place of, like,
it does
feeling
set,
insecure.
It does set a really good tone for the rest of the movie.
It does. He's got, like, when they read his letter, and this is a recent movie, but I mean, it's been out for a year or so. So, yeah. Go see it. We're not going to spoil too much. But there's a point when they read his letter, and he's being sincere and everything, but it just tears everybody apart.
Yes.
And it's not easily put back together. I love that scene. Yeah.
And I'll be honest, like, this one's starting off, I mentioned a few other probably holiday movies in this list, but it really gave me an appetite, if you will, for doing the holiday horror movies. We got to do a top 10 or something of those.
Well, do you have more of those on your list?
I think I have maybe one more that I want to talk about. And we could actually talk about it here because it fits the theme.
Yes.
Santa Sleigh.
Okay, that's why I asked, because we were going the same place. That's the other dinner party scene. Oh, my goodness. I think of a lot of these scenes we're talking about, the Indiana Jones scene, the Pan's Labyrinth scene, if you're sitting there thinking about it and you don't want to watch a whole movie, you could probably find most of these on YouTube, I'd imagine.
Probably.
To watch. This is one you should go and find on YouTube and watch.
This is a gem.
I think if you see this, I like this movie, but if you see this, you've seen the best 3 or 4 minutes of the movie.
Yes,
and
easily.
It's fair to say.
Yeah.
Why don't you set that one up?
Okay. So you have a whole family sitting around the table, and these are all like a bunch of celebrities that you'll recognize.
But are not like top tier. They're like the kind of
like
celebrities.
Like Chris Kattan.
Yes.
Like, you know.
And the nanny, Fran Drescher.
Yes, thank you for mentioning it, because I was about to forget her name. James Caan's, like, the presiding over the table.
Yes, and they're all so disparate that, you know, Rebecca Gayhart.
Yeah, I was going to say the girl from Urban Legend was in that, too.
The Latsima girl.
Yeah. So they have all these B-list celebrities, if you will, sitting around the table, just also kind of sniping at one another for various reasons. And then all of a sudden they start hearing, like, what's that sound like? Something's coming on the roof.
Jingle bells.
Jingle, yeah. Like, what's going on? And all of a sudden, Bill Goldberg,
the Jewish wrestler,
does a big like combat roll out of the fireplace towards the table and starts murdering them.
Kicks the Sharpay into the ceiling fan.
Yes,
and then Christmas music pops up, and he just you're right.
He just
murders
them all.
Somebody gets drowned in the eggnog bowl.
Yes. And there's James Caan gets like choked with a turkey leg.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, it is great.
It.
You got to see
Santa
it.
Santa Slay, that's Slay. And
it is pure silliness.
It's a complete
so good.
Desecration of the holiday. And that I kind of enjoyed it.
But
it was
enjoyable. I mean, and the rest of the movie, too. If you find this thing on a shelf somewhere, it's got the cheesiest cover.
You could probably rent it on Amazon
but
for a couple of
you
bucks.
Gotta
it's kind
rent
of worth it.
Because it's
a fun,
actually
bad
a lot of fun. It's even got a nice little stop motion animation sequence of like Jesus and the devil playing.
Santa and an angel playing curling.
Yes, playing curling. Yeah.
So great. It's fun. It's silliness, but it's fun. Santa Slay. That's quite the film.
Now, I've noticed a few very musical selections that you had talked about.
Yeah, well, I was trying to think about this. Tim Burton's Beetlejuice comes to mind.
Great movie.
We're talking about feast scenes. Beetlejuice is such a weird movie. Now, I know you're a big Tim Burton fan, Chris. What did you think about Beetlejuice?
I like that it's just kind of gleeful in what it does. It's got a lot of cool kind of creatures, his visual styles there.
He was starting to just get his style going.
It wasn't really like, it's not a serious movie. He's so just happy that you could tell everyone on this film loves what they're doing because it's just so crazy and slapstick. And just very entertaining and also kind of roasting being alive, you know?
Yeah, it's a weird movie because a lot of the scenes don't really connect to each other. Even the concept of Beetlejuice. So you have the couple who die in the house, Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin, and they're trying to scare people out. And that's a great premise for a movie, but it goes to many weird places. Like, in a sense, you don't even need the Michael Keaton Beetlejuice character.
Not at all,
He's like a weird side trip that shows up in the second half of the movie. And one of the best scenes is where the ghosts decide to scare their guests at this really gauche, grotesque, yuppie dinner party, which is really supposed to be the scary part. Yeah. The weird, horribly decorated home and the shrimp cocktails that are sitting in front of them. And then they make everyone, they possess everyone's bodies and they jump up and they do the banana boat song, which is the big, you know, it, like they're singing Harry Belafonte and dancing around, and then the shrimp come up out of the bowl and grab their faces and throw them out. And everybody's so thrilled. They think fantastic. It's the best dinner party they've ever been to. That whole thing is just so completely surreal that I feel like, in terms of the only stranger dinner party movie I'd ever seen, was The Exterminating Angel, the Louis Buñuel movie where everyone gets together and then they can't leave and they're stuck with each other, which is a classic. Have you seen Exterminating
Angel?
That should go in the queue. It's a great movie. I won't talk too much about it because it's a little bit more than just the feast concept. It's really about what happens when you put people in a room that think they are civil with one another, and then they can't leave. How long before that falls apart?
That's an excellent question.
Yeah.
Especially in today's day and age.
That doesn't play much into Beetlejuice, no. But it just remember it being such a strange, silly, wonderful scene. That could have been the movie. In a sense, it's almost its own short movie.
Yeah.
You know, the ghosts come in, they try to scare people by turning their own, like, upper crust flakiness against them.
Well, speaking of crust, there's a movie with, again, a musical element to it.
Which one is this?
House 4, wasn't it?
House 4 had the singing pizza. Yes. So the house movies, I was thinking about this. I think almost all the House movies, The House being a horror series from the 80s, which inexplicably...
We put in quotation marks, horror.
Horror, yeah. It ran from the 80s into the 90s, and I think that's funny because there is no House 3. Not really. Like, there's a movie with Lance Henriksen and Brian James that was released overseas as House 3, but in the States they jumped right to House 4.
So there's really so bizarre
House
1,
House 2, and House 3. House 4 does, in fact, have a singing pizza. Like, she orders the pizza, she opens up, and it starts singing, "I'm your pizza man," or something to her. She eventually has to kill it by throwing it down the garbage disposal and grinding it to pieces. Another scene that you can find on YouTube. Completely ridiculous.
Probably not a good feast scene,
well,
but definitely fits the...
No, but House 2 has a feast scene. House 2, which has no relation to the others, is House 2, the second story, where... And I think you and I were, when we did our horror, overlooked horror movies, we were talking about Royal Dano, the actor that was in Killer Clowns from Outer Space. He plays the moldering grandfather in House 2. He's an old West cowboy. And towards the end of the movie, the idea is that there's portals in this house that could take you to different times and eras. And kind of through various holidays, they keep encountering these things. Like, they have a Halloween party, and a barbarian steals the crystal skull that opens the gateways to time and space. And then at the end of the film, they're celebrating Thanksgiving, but it's the weirdest Thanksgiving dinner you've ever had. You've got Eric Gross, the actor, is standing there in front of everybody and giving his speech about why he's thankful, but there's like an Aztec princess sitting here. There's a prehistoric pterodactyl sitting next to her. And then he's got his buddy and the dead grandfather with his little worm, caterpillar worm that has a pug head.
Interdimensional full house.
Yes, right. They're sitting around the dinner, and when they go to pull the top off to reveal the turkey, the other dead cowboy climbs up out of the platter. You see his red hair with the turkey meat. He just climbs right up out of it. That kind of feels like my house at Thanksgiving.
So I can confirm
now
that is the case.
And I'm sure there must have been some scene involving food in the other House movie. Seeing as there's no House
most
3,
likely.
I don't know. Those scenes have always stuck out to me, particularly the House 2 Thanksgiving scene. Because, again, I'm kind of all about the absurdity. And I like absurdity in those sorts of scenes where you just take something and it's almost like a few minutes that could be a Far Side cartoon. You know, when I look at Beetlejuice, when I look at that movie... Another movie that comes to mind, and it kind of goes back to the Spielberg connection, is Young Sherlock Holmes. That do you remember this movie?
Yeah.
From the mid-80s, I think? 84?
Somewhere along there.
And
I'm not as good with the dates as you are.
That was when they were starting to really play around with the special effects, because the context of the movie, I think you have a character who's going around. It's been a year since I've seen it. There's a character who's going around and... shooting people with darts, I think, that caused them to hallucinate. Mm-hmm. So the movie has a lot of hallucinations. I think it was one of the first CGI sequences where this priest gets shot with a dart and this like stained glass knight jumps out of the window and attacks him, and it's a CG kind of an image.
Cool.
But there's one scene where a guy is getting ready to go in, and it's in like a Dickensian almost setting, and he goes in to have like dinner. I don't know if it's a Christmas dinner or what it is, but he sits down and he's like a roasted pheasant or something. And he's been shot with a dart, so the pheasant comes to life and starts clawing and pecking and attacking him. And he's basically, he dies there thinking that he's being attacked by this roasted pheasant. And then later in the film, Watson, who's a plump little British boy, because they're all young, he's young Sherlock Holmes, he gets hit with a dart and he sees this refrigerator full of snacks. Like donuts and Twinkies and crullers and stuff start jumping out and forcing themselves down his throat. It's like they're holding him down and they're just jumping off of a diving board into his mouth. So it's like it's the nightmare of the portly child.
That's right. Well, that's great.
So I think that deserves revisiting. But I think we've stayed long enough on the side of the cushy friendly.
You're right. You were so right, Nathan. I think it's time to move on to a little more horrible territory.
Yes.
So, one thing that immediately comes to mind when you're talking about things attacking you in the middle of a feast, again, a classic movie, I got to go with Alien, because everyone's sitting around eating dinner, and all of a sudden, something feels, and the alien pops out of the guy's chest.
I've had those events at my house too.
It feels very appropriate to talk about that one.
Alien. Oh my goodness. Yes.
I like to call that Dinnerus Interruptus.
That's a great one, because it kind of they
take their time to build that up too. They don't just immediately go to they're all sitting around eating dinner and then pop. They build their time. Everybody just kind of just talking, shooting the breeze for a while, a few minutes.
And what's great is
to
like
build normalcy to the scene.
The classic story or anecdote about that, of course, is that Scott didn't tell anybody that was happening.
Yeah,
so
that's so great.
They think that they're just filming this scene where they're talking, and they must have known something was going to happen, but it's not telegraphed. So when it happens, it just like you said, it literally interrupts the whole thing. But what's kind of great about that is everything we've talked about so far is kind of like someone purposefully taking the concept of the dinner and turn it on its head by how can we change what's on the menu? That's usually how you make it creepy. Or how do we change the tone so it's not the tone of the venerated feast or whatever? And I mean, if you look and think about fiction, then the idea becomes, well, what about if the feast is the eating, that communal thing is going on as planned and then something stops it? And the one that comes to mind is Sir Gawain and the Green Knight from classic literature, where they're having the great big feast and the Green Knight comes in and interrupts everything, and suddenly they're having a game of seeing who can chop somebody's head off. You know, 5 minutes ago they were having dinner, now they're going to chop a guy's head off. In an Alien, they're sitting there chilling out and suddenly this thing just tears its way out of the stomach.
Yeah.
We don't even know. I mean, we know now. We don't know that that's the nature of the creature.
Yeah.
We don't know what it was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when it just rips itself right there in the middle. I mean, had it done it in a chambered in his room away from everybody or anywhere else, but it runs across the dinner table. I mean, it's just like, bam.
Yeah.
Like, there's one side of that event, and then there's the other side of that event. And that was just such a really unnerving and arresting way to do that. Like, just have it not just tear itself out of his stomach, but kind of just tear apart what was going on there.
Yeah, I think that's a great one. Now, I remember earlier we had talked about Most Colorful Pudding. Now, you had another option for that, and I'd like to hear what you thought.
So, there's probably two choices here. They're both directed by the same guy, and he's a director and we've actually already talked about, because we mentioned both Lord of the Rings. Wait,
man, he's in here a lot.
Peter Jackson. Well, you know, I think Peter Jackson...
He knows his puddings.
Well, Peter Jackson liked possibly Lewis and possibly liked Tolkien. Likes to eat. I like to eat. I mean, and I think, you know, he also knows, coming from his horror background initially, that food is a way to, like, freak people out a little bit. Lord of the Rings has some gross scenes of Gollum tearing into raw fish. It has the meats back on the menu, boys, when all the guts come flying out. You know, there are some gross scenes involving consumption in the Hobbit movies. But his earlier movies, there was two I was thinking of, Dead Alive for Colorful Pudding.
That one's the lesser of the two.
Bad Taste. Bad Taste was the movie I was thinking about.
That's a winner. Psychedelic pudding in that one. When you talk about crazy ideas for a science fiction movie, this is one of the crazier ones out there. They have, takes place in New Zealand, I believe, like the rest of his movies.
Yeah.
From outer space, a group of aliens comes down to find a new meat to put on their intergalactic fast food menu.
They look kind of like wrinkly potatoes with eyes, sort of. Yeah, they're humanoid.
And they decide that human's good meat. We should put that on our fast food menu. So at one point, I think they all gather around and have some guy eat one of their meals. I forget exactly how it happens, but there's like this giant vat of radioactive green glowing like pudding or whatever.
And it's been a while since I've been Bad Taste, but isn't one of the aliens like the guy who makes the meal by vomiting it
up? Yes, he vomits it up.
So he's disgusting. He's throwing up the dinner.
To me, that's much one of the grossest things that could happen in a movie is vomiting. I am not a big fan of that. So that was gross, but I love the movie because it's ridiculous.
I mean, to be fair to both Bad Taste and Dead Alive, I think it would be accurate to say that this is even less disgusting than Seth Brundle vomiting on the like cheeseburger in the Fly movies to some degree. Like, I mean, that was very realistic. Cronenberg
this is
went
very
full
slapstick.
Out realism. The Bad Taste is almost Evil Dead 2 style, like grand old just goofiness.
Yes.
Almost, like you said, slapsticky, almost cartoonish. Mm-hmm. The pudding I was thinking of was in Dead Alive when there's an early scene. Dead Alive is a movie about a guy whose mother's bit by, the Sumatran rat devil monkey or something?
The Sumatran rat monkey, yeah.
And it bites his mother and passes this virus on. She's eventually turned to a zombie, but he's such a cowering, kind of sniveling mama's boy that he can't let go of mom, even though she's rotting, basically, at this point. And he invites people to
literally
come over, and I think the priest or somebody has come over to the house. And
the vicar.
Yeah, he's sitting there, and of course, kind of, which would lead us into Sweeney Todd, potentially.
True.
But the idea that, you know, you've got the clergy there who's kind of just, he's a big, heavy set guy, and he's just devouring this food, and, you know, and mom, for whatever reason, who's getting delirious and starting to fall apart at this point, like, hits her, like, bandaged pussy wound, which it jets a stream of like pink gel out of her wound and plops down in his custard, and he's stirring it around, and he's like, best custard I've ever eaten or something.
I remember at the beginning of that scene, he was like, they're all eating dinner, and there's like, they're all clearly full, and he's like, have you any dessert or something?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. So
he brings it upon himself.
Yeah, yeah. So he's now, and stuff like that is always like disgusting.
This custard's rich and creamy or something.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
So Jackson, he kind of had his hand on the like really gross, gross scenes like that. And I feel like, you know, we haven't seen a really... Jackson's kind of moved away. I feel like Sam Raimi, he needs to come back to the fold and give us another, like...
True.
What was Raimi's Drag Me to Hell, which had its own share of
that
vomit.
Was
for a PG-13 film, there's quite amount of vomit and liquids.
All kinds of bodily fluids in that one.
Oof. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, speaking of all the vomiting, I feel like I got to move on to this one just to get it out of the way. This one gave me the creeps because, like, it's kind of disgusting. This is actually on a comedy. If everybody's familiar with Monty Python, I'm sure. Let's talk about the meaning of life. There is a scene in that movie. Mr. Creosote. And he goes into this fancy upscale restaurant.
Big, heavy set, grotesquely.
Grotesquely overset. Thousands of pounds.
It looks like Jabba the Hutt in like a tux.
Essentially, yes. In a tuxedo. Yes. Yeah, he's all dressed up and everything. Goes in there and, you know, he's greeted by John
Cleese. I can't remember which one of the pythons is playing him, though.
I don't remember him, but I remember Cleese was in it, and he was. Yes, we also we talked about him in the first Harry Potter.
Yes, being he's the way. Right, right. He was a nearly headless Nick, right?
Yeah. So he's in there, and he's, oh, Mr. Creosote, welcome, welcome. You know, they welcome and sit him down to his table all by himself. And before he even gets started with a meal, like one of the waiters comes by and drops a bucket down next to him so he can vomit into the bucket and make room like a Roman vomitorium. It's so nasty. And it doesn't stop there. Like, it goes on for a while. He orders all this food.
Throwing it up.
He's just throwing it up. And the thing is, it's disgusting because, like, just chunks are, like, still on his, like, tux and everything. And it's just, it is beyond projectile. It's like they've got this power hose shooting this stuff out behind his head.
I can say this about Monty Python. The thing that sets Monty Python apart and perhaps elevates them in a sense from, like, your SNL or something is they would commit to it. They would fully commit, and they would go to the point where, like, you think you want to see this, we're going to make it very uncomfortable for you.
And this is a disgusting scene that I hopefully never see again, but I thought it was a clever point that they were going with. But,
and he eventually, I mean, a surprise to say he eventually explodes.
He orders all this food and he just keeps eating it and vomiting it up and eating and eating and eating. And finally, the waiter comes by and is like, after dinner, mint, sir. And he says, oh, I couldn't eat another bite, you know. And then he, like, grabs it and eats it. And he literally explodes.
And there are... He's seemingly... Of course, you know, because it's a weirdo skit, I think he's still somehow alive, but his, like, bloated carcass is exposed. Now you see his ribs, and there are hunks of him hanging off of the other patrons.
And now I feel very good, because now we've gotten past that one. Let's move on.
It's funny how gross that is, and yet that kind of point that it's also... I like the fact that when he's exploded, he's sitting there, and, like, the hunks of, you know, when someone is behaving in that sort of a way, the splash zone, so to speak, whether you're physically exploding or not, like, you've cast a pall on your fellow patrons.
Well, let's see, what would be a good one to move on to? For something completely different, Monty Python reference there. Now for something completely different. We actually had a little feast before I get into this one. Nathan and I, many moons ago, we were at an Indian restaurant, Indian buffet, and we were having a feast, and we were talking about this movie that Nathan had seen and I had not, and in the concept behind it, I was like, I have to see this movie. And of course, I'm talking about The Pit from 1981.
Oh, but of course you're talking about The Pit.
This is one, I think this is a one-and-done director, too, the guy who made the movie.
This is a very bizarre movie.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about it, because the way you described it to me so many years ago was so awesome.
There's not any... So, intended to be a horror film. I'm not really sure what kind of movie it ends up being. But you've got this young boy, weird little pervy dude.
Yes.
Who, like, he's kind of hitting on his babysitter. You're not quite sure who the perspective of the movie is, because at first it seems like it's him. But he's such a weird kid, and the actor playing him is so off-putting. You just kind of want to... You kind of want to hit him. Yeah. I mean, he's like a 12 or 13 year old. We're not talking about like a little 6-year-old boy. And I'm not advocating abuse, but he's very off-putting. He's a very weird, deranged little kid.
I actually don't feel bad because he's got his, like, bullies and stuff. I don't feel too bad.
Well, that's the kind of thing. He's like, you see that he has bullies, but then you realize that he tries to, like, blackmail the librarian. He's a very weird dude. He's trying to get the babysitter to give him sponge baths and stuff. I mean, he's a very odd kid. And then...
He has a special little friend, too.
He has a teddy bear that moves and talks. But you're never sure if it's supposed to be in his head or not, because there are scenes when the babysitter will walk into the room and the teddy bear's head will move to suggest, oh, it's alive. But we don't know what's up with it. We never know. We never, ever know what's up with it. We're not sure whether we're supposed to believe the teddy bear is in his mind. That's a weird movie in and of itself. Weird little creepy dude with his talking teddy bear that tells him to do horrible things. But then he finds a pit full of
troglodytes,
trollics, whatever he calls them, that trolls of a sort that are living down inside of a cave, and they're very shoddy looking. You just see the like eyes that they bought, somebody bought from like the dollar store, you know, little glowy orange eyes, and they're down in the pit, and he starts feeding them his enemies.
Yes.
But his enemies are just other kids. Like, they're pushing other kids into the pit to feed the troglodytes. And the babysitter at one point, I think, becomes a accidental casualty, and then her ghost is now haunting him too. So he's got a teddy bear that talks to him, he's got a ghost babysitter that is haunting him, and he's got a pit full of trolls.
It's a great, bizarre idea for a movie.
And it's a terrible
movie. It is a terrible movie. Like, I
it makes you feel pretty creepy just for watching
it. I feel like I'm chuckling more than I should about it, because it's not that entertaining.
It's a very strange movie.
But there is a scene in it that has stuck with me, and it's a scene of a birthday party that he gets invited to. And it's because this scene, they just show you the everyday horrors of, like, eating.
So wait, this movie's not on your list because I thought the feast element was he was feeding the kids to the Trollocs.
Oh no, this is for a legit feast. So this is all these, okay, that actually, I hadn't even thought of that, to be honest with you, Nathan. That's a good point. So we'll call this is a twofer right here, okay, really.
Fair enough.
No, the part I wanted to talk about was the birthday party he goes to.
I don't even remember.
Because there's all these kids there, and they're chowing down on cake, and they're like the director zooms in like on their faces while they're mashing cake into their mouths and stuff, and it was like the most weird, creepy little sequence.
Show me how the little piggies eat.
Yeah. So I thought that was like bizarre. You see,
that's hilarious. That old weird creepy movie about a kid feeding people to trolls. And
that's what I took from it.
The cake eating scene.
The cake eating scene. Yeah.
I'd say that I go check that out, but I have no intention of waiting through that movie ever again.
You know, that's a good point, because I think we found it somewhere at like Blockbuster that day.
It's so bad. So weird.
But moving on from that, let's talk about one of my favorite movies, actually. It's just very weird and surreal. If you've listened to the previous podcast we're talking about, Overlook Movies, you know that I love visually interesting things like Santa Sangre. You probably didn't care for it as much as I did. But
yeah, we're talking about Jodorowsky, right?
Yeah.
Alejandro Jodorowsky.
I love Eraserhead. It's a very strange
David
movie.
Lynch,
very Eraserhead. Weird visuals. Yeah. It's really interesting just to watch and observe. But there is a dinner scene in this. I don't know if you remember this one, Nathan, but there is a dinner scene where he goes to visit his girlfriend while she's still living with her parents.
That is a... Yeah.
And
this is an
like,
extraordinarily strange film.
Yes.
And there's... But with David Lynch, and I feel like we owe it to ourselves to do a Lynch podcast...
Definitely.
Because Lynch is we've been talking recently about various movies that try to be very visual and very strange and sometimes just don't quite succeed because mm-hmm. they're all visuals. I will give this to David Lynch. Not every one of his movies successful. I thought Inland Empire was really just someone disappearing up their own butt. But for about
that
three
may
hours,
have been the plot. You know,
and see, that's possible. I feel like that Lynch always does have a certain method to his madness. And Eraserhead's a movie where everything that's happening on screen is not really what the movie's about, per se. But the movie is about something. It's about something quantifiable. Like, it seems to be that Eraserhead is kind of about the fear of, like, getting married and having kids, or not getting married, but having kids and having a family, having responsibilities. And, like, everything that happens in that movie is almost like, hey, you go, you meet the parents, you sit down for your first dinner with them, it's awkward, you have a kid,
it's
hard
very,
and weird.
Very awkward.
In a sense, that's all Eraserhead is about. But in another sense, that's not what it's about. I mean, that is not what you're watching.
That's not.
The dinner scene's bizarre because aren't they eating very strange, bizarre things?
Okay, so yeah, they sit down, and it's almost like they've found something smaller than like a Cornish hen, but they have these tiny little birds that they serve on a plate, like a roasted bird. And as soon as, you know, the main character...
As soon as
he, like, pokes into one with a fork, it starts to, like, melt apart on his plate and, like, oozing from its...
and there's pipes, low-hanging pipes above their head, which is...
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that in that movie.
Terry Gilliam does that a lot, too. The weird pipes.
Yeah, so it was like weird melting chickens in that scene. It was very strange. If you're feeling adventurous, I'd say check it out.
Eraserhead's good. And the scenes, like, later when he's trying... And then the thing that eventually is his child is almost like another version of that weird melty chicken. Like, it's a weird, creepy little enshrouded thing. And the dinner scene, though, I think it does capture some of that really weirdness of...
Definitely the uncomfortableness
of, like, what it is to, like, be somewhere having dinner with people that you... You have an obligation. Like, there's that element of, like, there's the obligation where I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't feel good about it. So I don't really want to be doing this. But I'm doing it for another reason. I'm doing it for this person over here who I want to be with this person. So I got to take these people, too.
Yeah.
And there's a very just odd, weird scene. And that actually reminds me of a movie that doesn't have any much connection to it other than... the creepy eating scene was the movie Existence. Do you remember that?
That is one I have never seen. You've talked about that a few times.
So there is a... Existence is a... It's not that great of a movie. It's...
I remember there's a gun with, like, tooth bullets or something.
Yes. And so there's a sense of, like, there's worlds inside of, like, a video game. And you never know what layer of the video game you're in. And so there are weird... But Cronenberg, as opposed to, like, comes out the same year as The Matrix. But as The Matrix has these weird digital universes where you can kind of figure, oh, yeah, they're flying now, so they're not in the real world. They're somewhere else. Cronenberg's worlds, for the most part, always look real until something just absurd kind of happens. And it's not so much that a person can fly. It's that, like... the setting they're in just doesn't make sense anymore. There's one scene where they suddenly just see a, like, Chinese restaurant called Chinese Restaurant or something. I mean, you see some of those around sometimes. That's just sitting out in the middle of the woods. And it's sitting next to, like, a, like, harvesting plant that looks like they're not catching trout. It's a bio plant where they are taking these weird amphibian creatures and turning them into the bioport, which is the game unit that you plug into your back. Or the bioport's a hole in your back. You take the game unit. So they're taking these amphibians and turning them into that. But they're also serving them on the menu. So at one point, Jude Law orders this dish, and it comes to him, and he's confused because it's a very scaly, crustacean-y, bony dish, and he's pulling it apart and eating it. But as he's eating it, he basically finds the gun and assembles the thing he's eating into the gun, and then he... catches up in his mouth, he pulls out, and there's a tooth cartridge with the teeth in it, which he then sticks into the gun. So he builds the gun out of this dinner that he's eating. He's unveiling this weapon while he's eating this amphibious thing. It's very hard to explain, but it was very weird. It's very strange.
Well, that was definitely a bizarre sort of thing.
Well, yeah, and I feel like we're heading now into the final stretch here where we're into the really... We got a few really final kind of... I guess... We're at that point when we've talked about everything except for the one thing, the other white meat.
The thing that's most obvious probably for this
one. The long pork.
Yes, that's right. The cannibal culinary delights.
Yeah, and we talked about, you know, we left a lot of the movies where people wander into a village in the middle of a rainforest and get eaten movies because I feel like that makes up the majority of a cannibal movie.
We're just taking out the straight out Billy films, we'll call them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we got a few in here, but I think again the feast aspect, the movies we have here have some downright disgusting sequences.
Yes.
Two I'll hit right off the bat because they probably fall outside the kind of purview of the ones that you picked, Chris. But there's two. One of them is Jean Prigent's Delicatessen.
That's another weird movie. I love that movie.
I had just talked about that on PCN because it's a post-apocalyptic movie, but it deals with cannibalism. In a very weird...
And troglodytes. Kind of
and troglodytes. The troglodytes are vegetarians. That's the interesting twist. It's the people in the apartment complex you have to worry about. But they're... I feel like that movie also has some scenes of just meat being butchered. It's a little questionable what's happening. And then, you know, we had talked about Sweeney Todd. Sweeney Todd deals with the meat pies. But there was a movie from 1989 that Bob Balaban directed. I think it was 89. Called Parents. With Randy Quaid.
That is a bizarre movie.
Right. It's a little boy.
It feels like a fever dream.
It does. In 1950s, like, nuclear family, and he starts to kind of assume that something's a little bit off about mom and dad. And they're butchering people and eating them. And this movie, though, is not quite a full-blown horror movie.
No.
It's more like a very droll, very, very droll black comedy. I mean, wouldn't you say that's about the tone?
That's about, yeah.
Randy Quaid is the, like, button-down... 50s Ward Cleaver, you know, hint with the last name, but character who's just sort of you know, you wouldn't expect this, and it's like the cleavers if they ate and killed people, killed and ate people. And there's a weird scene I remember where I believe the little boy's teacher or somebody is lured to the house, and he's trying to communicate to her, but he has this weird, almost dreamlike scene where the sausages in the pantry with him start to like move and encase him, and like they're wriggling around him, and you're never really supposed to take it as serious, but it always reminds me of like the kids' like campfire song about Dunderback's machine, where he chops the children into meat, and the little boy sings, and the sausages do a little dance or something. You can look that up on your own time, but I just yes, and all the neighbors' cats and dogs will never more be seen. They've all been ground to sausage meat in Dunderback's machine. So that's check great. It out. Look it up, Dunderback's machine. And parents, I don't remember enough to tell you whether it was a good movie or not.
I didn't care for it. It did have some weird stuff.
I feel like it was maybe a little too droll, like a little too dry and not juicy.
They should have gone a little more one way or another with it. But
and there was a title I came across. We'll hit the last ones.
Let's hear it.
That I know you've seen and I haven't, but I feel like it has to tie into somehow. Big Meat Eater.
Oh my gosh, that was a weird movie. Yeah, so that one involves aliens coming to Earth, and it's like a Canadian movie, I believe.
Oh no.
And there was a rap sequence where like these two guys are talking and they start rapping about all the elements on the periodic table, and they're just singing that song with all the periodic table elements. It's really weird. But like,
were there gruesome eating scenes?
Not really. Like, there was a guy, I think at one point, who was like cutting people up and putting them in his like meat locker or something. But this wasn't a very over the top movie. I think at one point the reason that the aliens came down was that he was discarding all these meat scraps, and eventually like it turned into an element they called bolonium after it just sat there long enough.
Delightful bolonium.
You know, it's been literally, it's well over 10 years since I've seen that thing, so I don't remember a ton about it. It's just a very weird little movie. And it wasn't that entertaining. There was a dance sequence in it.
It's like I can only seem to remember the dance sequence.
The dance sequence bolonium. And the rap song. Yeah, I mean, the rap song is probably the highlight. But
never saw it. So now I guess we hit... There's three movies that you have listed, and I think they're pretty gross.
They are. Only one of them I don't really care for that much, and as a horror fan, it's going to shock some people. But I loved Ravenous. I thought that was an interesting movie. That was one you introduced me to.
Ravenous is fabulous. Now, Antoinette Bird, female director, only directed two movies, I believe, Priest and then this movie. And then she, tragically, you know, she passed. But Ravenous is a very weird, unique little movie because it's kind of a vampire story. It's also a Western story, but it's really kind of about the Donner Party and the cannibalism that kind of spreads.
Yeah.
But it has some of the most strange and off-putting sequences of meat cooking.
And strange and off-putting music sequences.
Yeah, Michael Dana, who did a terrific score for that movie, used a lot of weird... off-kilter banjo, strange strings. It's a score that I find I can listen to even aside from the movie. And in the movie, it creates a weird dissonance between what's kind of going on. There's a great line where David Arquette screams, "He was licking me!"
Yes!
And, and Robert Carlyle plays a really crazy character, Calhoun. And it's just, this movie's gruesome. And there's some feasting. It does go on. But you can really kind of see, like, I can see this being the product. If you ever kind of want to get the into the headspace of someone who has kind of decided, hey, I want to be a vegetarian, watch Ravenous. Because, I mean, I think they're pushing towards some of that. Like, there's this element of, like,
I remember
this
the beginning
is what it is to consume flesh.
I remember the beginning, it was Guy Pearce in that movie.
Yes.
Yeah, he's sitting down at a table where all the people, I think it was like at the presidential dinner or something he was at, and they're all sitting down to eat steaks, like bloody steaks. And he's looking at him, he's like, his stomach's turning. He's like,
There are scenes of just meat that are really pretty nauseating.
Yes.
But in the context, they're nauseating. But in a normal film, they wouldn't necessarily... It's not necessarily that they film them as grotesquely as like the lynch scenes or the cake-eating scene you meant. You know, it's more like once you know what's going on, any scene of meat cooking is just a little stomach churning. Yeah.
I'm actually going to talk about the one I didn't like, at the end. I'm going to move. There's one on Netflix right now that I saw probably about a year ago. It's called We Are What We Are. That is a very good movie. It's a nice, strange, like, family drama mixed with cannibalism.
Family drama if your family was cannibals.
Yeah.
But it deals with them in a realistic way.
Identity, like, who are we, you know. Like,
yeah, it's about this family and their problems. And their problems do extend beyond we eat people. But eating people is a big one.
They're like, well, this is how we've always done it, so this is what we're going to continue to do.
It's pretty good. And there's two versions. There's actually a Spanish language version that came first.
Really?
Which is a really good movie in and of
that
itself.
That I did not know.
But the American version was directed or created by... A group that had done a couple other movies, one of them being a kind of zombie rat movie called Mulberry Street.
Yes.
And a really good vampire movie called Stakeland.
Stakeland, yeah.
And We Are What We Are is in that same vein. I think this is a very good movie.
I do too, yeah, I enjoyed it.
It's and both versions are good, so you could track them out. I don't think you have to be that... this one's gross, but it's not overly
gross. It's not overly gross, no.
It's it deals seriously with a subject matter, but I wouldn't say it's nauseating.
No, however, this last one is...
this is the one people probably expected us to talk about right off the bat.
So we're just going to go into Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I'm talking about the Tobe Hooper 1974 original.
Not all the Michael Bay produced ones.
Nah, not all that crap. And actually, I'm not a big fan of this franchise or this movie, really. But obviously, you have to talk about it. We're talking about Horrible Feasts. There
this is
about truly
the most
chilling...
gruesome, yeah.
Well, honestly, I when I think about it, this movie's not very bloody or gory. There is a little bit of that. It's mostly implied violence in this movie. And, like, with the exception of maybe some language, I could see it being toned down almost to a PG-13 level. To me, this is not a very...
The violence, but not the disturbing nature.
The disturbing nature of it is very
strong. The removal
strong.
Of the free will is what I think makes really... makes for the gruesome eating scene. You know, you get silly stuff like Hannibal, Silence of the Lambs. These are movies we could have talked about, but didn't. Mm-hmm. But like Hannibal, where he's got what's his name eating his own brains, like that's mm-hmm. just kind of to me stupid.
Yeah,
but something about that dinner scene where the kids, you know, they have the chance to get out, they think they're saving themselves by running into the house, and they've gone mm-hmm. out of the frying pan into the fire essentially.
And it's, again, a matter of family traditions and stuff like
that. Right, and there you have that family tradition being turned ahead because this is what we do. And you're just
and this is, like, the thing that creeped me out the most, I think, was that the old grandpa is basically almost dead. He's almost, like, catatonic. And they're like, grandpa's got to do the killing. He's always been the one who does the killing. So they hold his hand with a hammer to help him to, like, knock this girl on the head
right,
with the hammer.
Right, and
there's
that,
like,
that's
oh my
aspect
gosh.
Of, like, from... the perspective of the family. This is a warm, like
warm,
this is
warm
a thing.
Moment. Yeah.
Yeah, and yet you are here being murdered by these people.
It's almost like being ganged up by your own family.
Yeah. Like, so yeah, it's a very, very weird movie. I agree with you. I'm not really the biggest fan of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I really don't like much of what Tobe Hooper has done outside of that. I'm of the camp that gives Spielberg most of the credit for Poltergeist. So no, mm-hmm. not really feeling that one. But I know, but
I feel
right,
that does
scene
definitely.
Has to kind of be talked about because it is so
iconic.
Kind of, yeah, iconic and sort of disgusting. But I mean, there's lots of weirdo, creepy eating scenes in films.
Tons.
We probably,
yeah, and you know what was on. Weird? We talked about what we wanted to discuss in the podcast, and I thought to myself, geez, there's not many I can really think of. But as soon as I started sitting down and like writing down, okay, this one we get to talk about, I was like, okay, wait a minute. Then there's this movie, this movie, and this movie. And the list just kept growing. I was like, there's actually a ton of, like,
I think too, the
this
is
subject
is
matter in
some
films.
Of the really gross ones happen in movies that aren't really that good. So you kind of forget
yes.
about. Like, nothing.
There's
but,
some that I didn't want to
do
talk
you remember
about,
the movie Nothing But
about.
Trouble?
Yeah.
With the Chevy Chase movie where they have this dinner scene where Dan Aykroyd's this creepy judge in this town, and they sit down for dinner, and he has that little train that has all the sausages. The long sausages, and they're in those, like, the sheep intestine tubes or whatever, and he's trying to eat that sausage, and, like, he's, you know, it's just, they're all watching him eat it. It's very gruesome and gross,
yeah.
And you got them eating the, slurping the monkey brains and Clue, mm-hmm. and, I mean, comedies probably have a field day with that sort of thing, but one of the best, it's not a feast, but Tom Hanks eating that anchovy cracker in the movie The Burbs. where he's going over to the creepy neighbors. He's trying to make peace with them, and they offer him a snack. And, of course, all the rest of his neighbors that put him up to go over there, they don't want any part of it. But yeah. Someone's got to take the peace.
Take the one peace for the offer. Team.
So they give him that old, they don't know how old it is or anything. They give it to him on a little, like, it's like a Ritz cracker. And you just watch Hank's, like, gum this thing.
Oh,
eating it. You can hear it mashing around in his mouth. While he's, yeah,
that's another great movie, by the way. The Burbs is
the classic. Burbs, and The Burbs, in a sense, deals with the prospect of cannibalism.
Yes.
But the him eating that sardine cracker was just, that was rough.
Well, now that we've appetized people,
go and enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner. And look on the bright side, because could it be worse than this? So this is where, though, it could. It very well could. So, not to go into too many details, but I did have an incident at a Thanksgiving that will remain unidentified.
He's doing it, folks.
I am. We were sitting around. Everybody, we weren't even drinking. There was no alcohol really involved here. We were drinking Pepsis.
That's what makes this so shocking.
Yeah. So there were. I mean, I think we had some wine, but I mean, I maybe had a glass or something. Yeah. And everybody was drinking Coke and Pepsi. And there was somebody at this event who, well, I'll tell you what happens after I reveal what I did. So I walk over and I pick up my Pepsi that had been sitting over on the table near the couches there.
20 ounces.
Yeah, 20 ounces. So I pick it up. I take a sip of this stuff, and immediately I know I've made a bad choice. And I know I've done the wrong thing, because my mouth bursts into, like, feels like flames, like it's just instant, like, menthol overload, and there's hunks and, like, shrapnel in my mouth, and I'm like, what have I? And then I know, because one of the people that has come here chews tobacco and has drained their Pepsi and has refilled it by spitting into it
with Bruce.
Tobacco, and I have just put it in my mouth, and everyone else who sees me, the register of surprise in my eyes, knows exactly what has happened.
That's so disgusting.
And some people begin, like, sympathy gagging on my behalf. And I'm telling this right now, and I may still cut this from the podcast because it's pretty gross. And I run up, just go upstairs and evacuate as much of this as possible. Wow. Trying to brush it.
And you know what?
Brush the splinters of tobacco out of my teeth.
I'm actually glad I was at my sister's that year, because I think that might have been a little too much for me. That's pretty disgusting. And I feel bad for you. That was bad.
Everyone, have a great Thanksgiving.
Yeah, guys.
We'll be back soon. We hope you enjoyed it. Let us know what your favorite gross or imaginative dinner time scenes are, because I'm sure we've forgotten some here for certain. And we will talk to you next time. Take care.
Thanks
for listening,
guys.
Thank you for listening to tonight's episode of The Phantom Galaxy. We hope you enjoyed it, we hope you weren't too grossed out, and we hope you have a very happy Thanksgiving with family and friends. If you're interested in entering a contest to win a copy of the 2011 version of The Thing on Blu-ray, you can do so by going to our website at www.phantomgalaxy.podbean.com and following us there. We'll take all the names who followed us, and we will draw a winner, and we will announce it on one of the future upcoming episodes. The music you heard tonight comes from ambient artist Stellar Drone. You can find a lot of Stellar Drone's music on www.stellardrone.bandcamp.com. Again, have a great holiday, and thank you for listening to The Phantom Galaxy. Until next time, I'm Nathan Bartlebaugh.